just this is, I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, just in case I do need to. In any event, good morning, Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court. In this particular case, which is before you pursuant to writ of certiorari, Ms. Rivers, the defendant, was convicted of the charge of harassment for slapping her son in the face. There are basically two main issues before the court in this matter, the sufficiency of the evidence, and more importantly, the application of the parental discipline justification defense. With respect to the insufficiency of the evidence, it basically does tie in with the parental discipline justification defense. So there will be some overlap in terms of my arguments on both. The court is certainly aware of the elements of harassment, which basically states that the person commits the offense of harassment if with the intent, that's the important point, with the intent to harass, annoy, or alarm the other person, that person strikes, shoves, or kicks, or otherwise touches another person in an offensive manner, or subjects the other person to offensive physical contact. In this case, the complaining witness's testimony was not only inconsistent, it was also contradictory and confusing as to exactly when this particular event occurred and when it was reported to the police. For example, he initially testified on direct that the incident had occurred on a Thursday, January 31st, 2005. He had left the house the same night of the incident and reported the incident to the police the next day. However, on cross-examination by counsel, he then changed his testimony to say, I did not leave the house the night of the incident after, I'm sorry, it was the next night on the 14th. And then he reported the incident to the police the next day, another day down the line. The state concedes that certain findings of facts, conclusions of law, were or may be erroneous in their brief. For instance, finding fact number 8, which basically dealt with the reporting of the incident to the police, they concede that that finding of fact was erroneous. Finding of fact number 10, which stated that the complaining witness testified that at the time of the offense, he was doing well in school, both academically and behaviorally. Again, the state concedes that that's an erroneous finding of fact or conclusion of law.
Mr. Look, doesn't contradictory and inconsistent testimony go to credibility?
It does, Your Honor.
And isn't that the province of the trial court?
It is. However, I believe that it is also subject to scrutiny under whether or not it constitutes substantial evidence. Credibility is the province of the trier of fact. And, but again, I think there is some limitation as to what they based their decision on. So in looking at all these items which I'm pointing out, I believe that despite the court's decision, it was erroneous to give that much credibility to his testimony.
Mr. Luke, what is the standard for substantial evidence?
Standard, Your Honor, is substantial evidence as to every material element of the offense charged is credible evidence, which is of sufficient quality and probative value to enable a person of reasonable caution to support a conclusion.
And so what here constituted lack of substantial evidence?
Well, Your Honor, the fact that he changed, different parts of his testimony, both on direct and cross, I think that certainly, the quality of his testimony would certainly be suspect because of, the way he was changing his testimony throughout the trial.
Well, you cite several cases. Any cases you cite similar to the incident here?
Well, in getting into the parental discipline justification defense, there are numerous cases, including, I think, a case which was just published yesterday, Your Honor, the Montevelli case, which deals with the issue of sufficiency and parental discipline justification defense. And I think a lot of the arguments which are made in that particular opinion are relevant to this particular case.
Well, Mr. Look,
sir.
The complaining witness testified that on the evening in question after dinner, it was Jalen's turn to do the dishes, didn't he?
That's correct, sir.
And that Jalen didn't want to do it, and so your client instructed the complaining witness to do the dishes.
That's correct, sir.
And the complaining witness talked with Jalen, apparently persuaded him to do the dishes, and the complaining witness went to his room and played chess with his friend. That was his testimony.
That's correct.
Was it the prerogative of the trial judge to believe that testimony?
That is correct, sir. But the thing
is, if believed, where was the misconduct?
Well, even if that is correct, even if you believe that his version of the events is correct, my client, I think, had a right as a parent, when she had in fact instructed him to do it when Jalen didn't want to do it, that it was his obligation to do the dishes.
So in your view, the parental discipline defense is an absolute defense to a charge of harassment, so long as the parent has instructed the child to do anything?
If it's a reasonable instruction, sir, I believe so. And in this case, where even though the complaining witness did feel that it was not his turn to do the dishes, there was conflicting testimony on that. However, apparently in the decision, the court did, I guess, feel that the complaining witness's testimony was more credible. But the thing was, there is still, I guess, some indicia that there was perhaps an argument or a discussion between the complaining witness and this other minor who was supposed to do the dishes. And if mother was not apparently satisfied with the way it was handled, then I believe she had the right to go and speak to him about it, which she apparently did. And I think the findings of fact indicate that there was a dispute about the dishes.
Mr. Luke, there was a dispute about the dishes, but what's the testimony or what's the evidence in terms of why did the mother, what did the mother say was the reason why she had to make contact with him, hit him?
My understanding that she went there to talk to him about the dishes situation because...
But why did she strike him? What was she trying to discipline him for? Didn't she say that he cursed?
That is correct, sir.
Okay. So the reason why she wanted to discipline him was because she said he cursed at her.
That is correct, sir.
And he said he did not curse at her.
Correct.
And the judge found that he was more credible than she was.
That is correct, sir.
Right. So the judge found essentially that he did curse. I mean, that he did not curse. And she struck him without reason.
Well,
right?
Well, sir, the initial reason why she approached the complaining witness.
No, I understand the initial reason,
okay.
But her explanation was, I did not strike him for not doing the dishes. I struck him for cursing at me.
That's correct.
So that's where the parental discipline comes in, right? Okay, so the judge believed that she was not telling the truth.
With respect to that portion of her testimony, yes.
Right.
I guess, but where we're looking at is whether it was, whether she approached him for the purpose of disciplining him for, I guess, arguing with these other minor fictitious, or whether, because he had cursed at her, she had a justifiable reason for being there. And, you know, whether or not he cursed at her, it's true that the court probably believed that he did not curse at her, but there may have been some other exchange of words which may have led to a discipline.
Well, in finding number six, the court found that Gary testified he did not know why defendant was hitting him. Then the judge wrote in, though, semicolon, he had earlier disputed dinner chores with another minor child residing in the household.
Correct.
So from that, did the court apparently draw a connection between defendant striking him and the dinner chores?
We would so argue, Your Honor. I think the court, in I guess putting that in the findings, did recognize that she did have a justifiable reason for going to confront the minor about that. And that's what we believe the connection is between that phrase and Mr. Wiss's court has noted.
Is there any place in the record which specifically states why the mother struck her son? In her testimony, did she indicate the reason for striking her son?
On cross-examination, I believe she was specifically queried about that, and she did indicate that, although initially she did go to talk to him about the dishes situation, when she did approach him, I guess he had cursed at her, and that's why the incident occurred.
Mr. Look, finding of fact 9 indicates to which, and you have not contested finding of fact 9, indicates that Gary said he had, or that whatever, Gary had said he had never used a curse word directed at any adult. Now, if it's not contested, it's a binding, isn't that true?
That is true. Yes.
Okay.
With respect to the
if there was no connection to the dinner chores, what would the reason be for mother going up to the room and striking Gary out of the blue?
Well, that's exactly the point. What reason would she have to go up there? Apparently, there must have been some connection between the incident involving the dishes and her going to Gary's room. And that we believe is the reason the court had put that particular phrase.
Even if there's substantial evidence in the record to support a finding of the court, do we necessarily have to agree with that?
No, Your Honor. I believe the court does have the discretion to reverse the conviction.
Well, I think what Justice Acoba is alluding to is the proposition that despite substantial evidence to support a finding of fact, if we're left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made, we can still set the finding of fact aside Assuming that, well, apparently the son also testified that when his mother confronted him, she appeared to be incredibly angry. Assuming that it was in fact Jalen's turn to do the dishes, but nevertheless mom told son to do them, and he didn't do them, and she was very angry about that, and confronted him, but he didn't curse at her, although she claimed he did. What's the mistake that's been made in the findings of fact that we should have a definite and firm conviction has been made?
Well, even though the court found that he may not have cursed at her, certainly there may have been some exchange of words which may have resulted in her doing what she did. Under the circumstances where I don't think the minor was very pleased himself with the situation where he was having to be instructed to do the dishes when it was somebody else's turn, and regardless of whether or not he did not curse at the mother, I believe there were probably some actions or some indication of displeasure on his part, which may have provoked the situation.
In the cases you cited, was the trial court reversed on its findings?
In several cases, it was, Your Honor, in State versus De Leon, State versus Kaimi Moku.
Well, that's the reason you cited them, right?
Correct. Of course, there's other cases where the court has also affirmed the convictions, such as Crozier.
How do you distinguish those?
Well, if you look at the nature of the punishment, I think there's certainly a significant difference between what took place in this case compared to Crozier or Tanielu, where there was significant injuries, bruises, extreme pain, unable to sit for weeks, lacerations, contusions. I believe in this case, the only thing that the minor said was that he was slapped about 7 times. On a scale of 1 to 10, slaps were probably a 4, and the slaps all occurred in a period of a couple of seconds.
Mr. Look, in the other cases, yes, were they also harassment cases, or were those abusive household member cases?
It varies. Let's see.
Stalker was harassment, as I recall.
Correct. Stalker was harassment. Tate was harassment. This Tani Montebello, which is the latest, I believe, was an abuse. Crozier, I believe, was abuse. Tanialo, I think, was abuse also. So I think in comparison to these other cases which have been cited, where the injuries, if any, in this case were very minimal.
How long did the pain last in this case?
There was no real indication in the record. He just testified that it hurt at the time, but there's no testimony regarding the duration of the pain, nor was there any evidence regarding any bruises or other injuries suffered as a result of the slaps. He's a 17-year-old senior. There wasn't any evidence about, his size or his weight, during trial. And I think it's, you know, under 703-309-1, which is the parental discipline justification defense. The commentary is clear that the statute sets a fairly simple and unexceptional standard. The right of parents to use force to discipline their children is recognized, subject to clear requirements not to cause, I think it was underlying permanent injury. And I think clearly in this case, there was no injury even close to that level. And in the Montevalli case, which the court recently decided, it dealt with, I guess, mother disciplining a child for not attending her tutoring classes, including hitting her with a plastic hanger and a brush and another tool on her arm.
Mr. Luke, in the Montevalli case, there was no dispute as to the reason for discipline?
That's correct, Your Honor.
In this case, it seems to be a dispute.
In a sense, I would say there is, Your Honor, but I think, again, going back to the fact that her reason for approaching him over the dinner chores issue, I think certainly gets over that hurdle. And in that sense, that is not disputed about why she approached him. I think what is disputed is what occurred subsequently.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question, Mr. Look. This may seem extreme to the point of absurdity, but suppose you had a parent who was concerned or preoccupied to the point of obsession with the matter of original sin. And that parent made a judgment that for the safeguarding or promoting of her child's welfare for his own good, he would be administered 7 slaps a day to beat the devil out of him, literally. Mm-hmm. Lasting a few seconds per session, pain on a scale of 4, on a scale of 1 to 10. Would that parent have be immune from a charge of harassment?
Well, in your situation, Your Honor, I think you're indicating that this would occur like on a daily basis.
Right.
In this case,
in the sincere belief mm-hmm. that the child needed the devil beaten out of him every day.
Well, in that case, it's a continuing course of conduct. In this case, it would be an isolated incident.
Pick one day out of the continuing course of conduct. Would the parent be immune from a charge of harassment?
Under those circumstances, probably not, sir.
Why?
Given the justification.
Why?
Well, notwithstanding the fact that she may be a religious zealot and, you know, perhaps not totally competent. I mean, is that reasonable or reasonably proportional to his misconduct? In those circumstances, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
So there are circumstances in which you would concede that the parents motivation for administering parental discipline could be sufficiently unreasonable that the parental discipline defense would not apply.
Certainly, certainly. And I think the court has, you know, enumerated those types of reasons in various cases which it has decided. And I think if you compare those cases to the present situation, it is nowhere close to the type or the.
I'll grant that my hypothetical is pretty extreme.
It is, sir. Especially compared to your past cases.
Although probably not unheard of or out of the question.
That's true. It probably may occur. We would just say, Your Honor, that we don't feel that her discipline was excessive in light of her son's age. Certainly there's a dispute about the alleged misconduct, which was either this dispute with the younger child over the dinner chores or the cursing at the defendant. Apparently, in the court's findings, they found the complaining witnesses or the son's testimony to be more credible and did not find that he had cursed. However, that does not mean that there was not an exchange of words between the two. We would argue that in reviewing the totality of the circumstances, her discipline was not so excessive that it, quote, severed any relationship between the use of force and the welfare of her son, which might be considered reasonable, which was cited in the Taniyama case. Even if the son's version of the administration of the slaps is believed, Mrs. Rivers' actions in giving her son 7 mild slaps in several seconds, which apparently caused him some pain but left no marks or bruises, was not so outrageous behavior that it would take her actions out of the realm of parental discipline. Her son did not suffer any lingering pain or lasting disability. Further, unlike the Crozier and Taniyama case, there was no testimony to indicate that her son's alleged injuries were that severe or considered excessive. The discipline used by Ms. Rivers was reasonably proportional to her son's misconduct, and she believes was necessary to punish his misconduct. The state has not disproved any of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. Ms. Rivers has proved all 4 of the Crozier requirements for invoking the protection of 703-3091. Since the state has failed to disprove any of these elements, we would ask that the trial court's decision in convicting Ms. Rivers be reversed. Thank you.
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Brian Vincent on behalf of the state of Hawaii. This case is about credibility, basically, and the trial court, in its findings of fact number 14, stated that the minor's demeanor and manner of testimony resolved the conflicting testimony in favor of the state. I think that's been covered pretty well by the questions that have been asked of the defense counsel at this point, but I would like to address Justice Levinson's hypothetical question. And my answer to that is when you look at HRS 703-3091A, the relevant portion of that statute says and is reasonably related to the purpose of safeguarding or promoting the welfare of the minor, including the prevention or punishment of his misconduct. And that makes it almost sound like including the prevention or punishment of misconduct is a subset of the larger set of things reasonably related to the purpose of safeguarding and promoting the welfare of the minor. I would suggest that a fair reading of this statute would require misconduct on the part of the minor, or some sort of defiance of authority, or perhaps even the threat of imminent misconduct. But without misconduct, the whole reason for the parental discipline defense, I think, disappears. And in this case, the trial court.
That makes sense. I don't have any problem with the logic of your remarks, but I don't think that's what the statute says. I think the statute says that misconduct is a subset or prevention or punishment of misconduct is a subset of safeguarding or promoting the minor's welfare. I rather suspect that empirically the cases that your office brings involve misconduct, but I don't think the statute requires it.
That's correct. And all the cases that have been referred to involve some sort of misconduct, and that's why the state argues that the factual situations of those cases are not relevant to those cases. To this case, those cases all involved judgment of whether or not the discipline meted out was excessive, or the degree of the punishment, rather than whether there was misconduct to punish. And I agree that the a literal reading of 703.309.1a could almost support the reading that you give in your hypothetical, right? But I think that one of the canons of statutory interpretation is that a statute should not be read in such a way as to render it absurd. And I would suggest that an interpretation that would allow parents to commit harassment against their children would be absurd. It would nullify the harassment statute with a relation to parents striking their children in an offensive manner. And just in response to the issue of whether or not this could have been related to the minor failing to do the dishes, this court's already made note of at least one of the times where the defendant denied that was the reason why she was doing that. Page 61 of the transcripts, DPA asks, and it wasn't having anything to do with the chores, right? Defendant answers no. And then later on page 62-63, she says, yes, and in between his name calling, yes, I popped him, yes, I did. DPA asks, and that's the only reason why you popped him? Yeah. Later on, I think something that's actually fairly telling, that's where the DPA, asks the defendant, and what are the consequences for people not following the chore chart? No TV, no video games, you don't go to the outside, you don't get to go to the beach because we live right across from the beach. You don't get to pick a video when you go to Blockbuster. Later on it says, what was the privilege you tell him you were not going to be taken away. He was not leaving the house the entire week. In other words, for not doing the dishes, her punishment would be grounding, these other things, not striking. And I think that gives you a window into her subjective thinking in this case. So in conclusion, I would ask this court to dismiss the defendant's writ for application for writ of certiorari because the Intermediate Court of Appeal summary disposition order affirming the defendant's conviction in this case contains no grave errors of law or fact and is not obviously inconsistent with the appellate law, case law of this state. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Luke, anything further?
Just briefly, Justice. I note that the prosecutor did refer to basically looking at the type of misconduct which was alleged to happen to justify the parental justification defense. He's saying because the findings were such that it did not find that the son had cursed at mom. But again, the question is whether or not he's not doing the dishes, was that sufficient reason to punish him? You know, in these other cases, for instance, as in Stalker, the boy was slapped because he didn't come to the father after the father called him. I mean, is that sufficient, you know, basis for slapping a child because he doesn't come when you call him? Or in State versus Tate, where I guess the daughter was blocking his way when he was trying to get to something and he slapped her again. I mean, that's the basis for the misconduct in that case. We would argue that, you know, in the present case, that the misconduct is similarly at that level, if not, you know, higher, where there is a reason for, at least a subjective reason in her mind, what she believes, why the punishment was necessary. That's all. Thank you, sir.
Court will take this matter under advisement.
The state has 174 days, and that we submit.
What do you have to cover?
Three sections.
The three sections.
Subsection two, which is all the Yin ruled on it, which is exceptional circumstances causing court delay. And again, it's been dealt with that way, but the C8 is the out of the record place to hang your hat. And the C3 is our observation that pretrial extensions overlap the proposed trial date by 2 weeks. As far as these periods of extension, clearly, the way the courts are operating now, Judge Chang has issued a memorandum indicating that all pretrial motions have to be filed 4 weeks prior to trial. They're not even going under Rule 12C in the 21-day period anymore. So this court is probably not going to see these kinds of extensions. And the Judge Chang is enforcing this 4 week prior to trial rule absolutely ironclad. It's very difficult to get a motion in that 4 week period. But this approach of 21 days, it seems to me clear that if in a case like this where you have something like 3 months of extensions, and again, I see them as C3 exclusions, not C1, that defendant can't seek all those extensions and then come back several years later and argue that under Rule 48 he hasn't had a speedy trial. In terms of the grand jury transcript, I make the observation that it was requested on April 1st, 1982, and the indictment was in March. I believe that the grand jury transcript was necessary for the one later pretrial motion on insufficiency of evidence, but I submit it was not necessary for the even later pretrial motion, May 18th, 82, which was pre-indictment delay. So there was a motion filed something like 6 weeks after the original 21-day period of pretrial motions was up on pre-indictment delay, which was a motion that was ripe literally at the time of the indictment, and it did not require the grand jury transcript.
So you don't think the defendant was rather anxious to go to trial anyway?
No, I sort of have a feeling this is another case where somebody's using a technical rule. Our office is handling about 4 or 5 briefs a month on Rule 48. And I understand that this court congestion thing is causing this court problems. I don't think you have to get to it in this case. I think the 41-day period is amply covered by either one of those three sections. And the state, as I'm going to address the 78-day period, I don't have any more record than you do to look at. We just simply don't need it in order to prevail. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Esser, we have a problem with your answering brief regarding your asking us to make it, if it is dismissed,
yes,
without prejudice.
Yes. You can't do that. I'm sorry if we asked you to do that. If you want to remand, that's one thing, but I don't think this court is in a position to do that.
But assuming that it's sent back with an instruction to make a determination whether it's with or without prejudice, what is the effect of granting a motion without prejudice on the 6 month period? Do we have a new clock, or do
is, I guess you'd have to have a new club.
Yeah, it's going to be State Be Fair, is what it would be. State Be Fair, we have a third run, go around. State Be Fair says that if Rule 48 dismissal.
State Be what?
Fair, F-A-I-R. I can't give you a site, 63 Hawaii something. If you had a Rule 48 dismissal without prejudice, then the thing starts over again under B2 or B1.
The prior time when this case was taken,
yes,
was when it was dismissed by the prosecutor.
Yes.
Why didn't you ask for a new clock at that time?
Because that exception comes under C6, and it's necessary if there's a dismissal that it be on motion of the defendant. That's the only way you can start with a new clock under Fair and under B1 or 2. And we moved to dismiss, so we had to take the C6 exclusion.
You knew you couldn't get a new clock. Why should we give you a new clock? Why should anybody give you a new clock now? Why should anybody give you a new clock now and you couldn't get one then?
Well, because this clock was ordered by defendant when he made a motion to dismiss under Rule 48.
Yeah, but it occurs to me you caused this problem by dismissing the case in the first place. Now you want to get a whole new clock started when you couldn't get a new clock at that dismissal. When you came back on the second indictment, you know how much time you had.
That's correct.
Well, if you couldn't come in within that time, why should the court say, well, okay, we'll give you a new clock?
The only thing I can say is Rule 48 is a series of technical rules that may not be grounded on rationality.
Yeah, every time you say technical, I think of that damn officer who gave me a ticket going down the hill when I was going 40 to 35 mile an hour zone. You know, technical runs both ways.
That's true.
So,
that's true.
Why should anybody give you a new clock?
Well, I make the observation that defendant did not appeal the speedy trial issue. And the reason I think that defendant didn't is because speedy trial is based on prejudice in the real world. And whenever defendant comes in strictly on Rule 48 and decides that a two-year delay on the speedy trial isn't there.
Then what theory would we use to give you a new clock? I mean, is it just...
I don't think this court has any discretion.
Well, what theory would the lower court give you a new clock?
The lower court...
What standards would the lower court use in giving you a new clock?
Under extension, the standard is the seriousness of the crime, doing justice, upholding the intention of Rule 48, which Your Honor would have some problems with. Under State v. Extension, I believe it is clear the state would get a without prejudice ruling.
Really?
And I make that observation because although Your Honor points out that the state caused the termination of the first prosecution, it was the state indicated it was ready to go to trial in August. And on October 8th, the witness was on the mainland. A policeman quit and took off. And I don't think that it's chargeable to the state when it sends out its subpoenas in September and cannot obtain a chief witness. It had to go to grand jury the second time without that witness because it took like 4 months to obtain his appearance. So I put that under C4 subsection I, which says if the state doesn't have the evidence and its due diligence tries to get the individual, that's not chargeable to the state either. So we probably have a C4 exclusion for that change if we didn't have a C6.
Well, we're assuming a situation where you didn't get exclusion so that you've gone past the 6 months, right?
Yes.
Okay. So you can't argue all these exclusions. My question is, why don't you say, what is Rule 48 for if you go through it and you mess up in the 6 months and then somebody's going to say without prejudice and give you a whole new clock? Well, why should we play all these games to start with?
I believe it's when the trial court makes an observation. Rule 48 went through various drafts. One of the drafts was mandatory. 6 months dismissal, prejudice gone. Another one said that they may dismiss and left out the prejudice thing. In other words, the trial court exercises discretion that way. What we are left with is that they shall dismiss, but they can do it without prejudice. And I think what it is essentially doing is leaving us a certain amount of discretion on the trial court.
Yeah, well, a certain amount of discretion, but I hear you say, well, lots of discretion, not a certain amount. I mean, just any old time, unless they can prove prejudice. Or
you know what State v. Fair said? State v. Fair said that if we don't see any potential abuses, because this is exactly the State v. Fair situation, and A, they said we don't see any abuses of this process, and B, they said defendant is left with protecting himself with a speedy trial argument. Obviously, you don't have a new clock because of speedy trial. The problem is under speedy trial, which defendants, there is no intermediate or Supreme Court opinion successful thus far on the speedy trial level. I realize that. It's a hard road to go. But you do have the opportunity to come in and say prejudice, extensive delay, the state caused it for reasons of tactical, whatever. And so that's what you're left with. I would argue you're left with the speedy trial argument, which is much older than Rule 48.
Thank you.
I have lots of considerations about some of the factual representations the state has made, but I'm not going to try to address them because there isn't time. I would like to point out, with respect to this period from May 31st to June 28th, or the period at some point in May, this case was taken off the trial calendar in Judge Chung's court, and instead of being reset, it was essentially continued until calendar call date, and then it was put on the calendar call. And on the one hand, the state argues that the case didn't go to trial on May 16th because there were stipulations pending, possible pretrial motions could be filed, and on the other hand, the state's arguing that the case didn't go to trial because there was court congestion and because Judge Chang was trying to clean things up at that point. And I suggest that there's no evidence in the record to support either of the state's arguments. I suggest that all we know is that the week of May 16th, the trial judge didn't think this case could go to trial because of court congestion, because of the chronic court congestion that had been going on all this time. And at some pretrial conference on some unknown date prior to May 16th, the decision was made to continue the case.
You're talking about 1983?
Yes, sir.
Well, according to the record on appeal, on May 24th, stipulation for extension of pretrial motions and order was filed.
So that was after the trial was taken off, then?
Well, on May 9th, stipulation for extension of pretrial motions and order. May 5th, stipulation for extension of pretrial motions and order. April 15th, stipulation for extension of pretrial motions and order.
But just because a pretrial motion can be filed doesn't mean that trial is going to be continued. I mean, in this case,
but it's a pretty clear indication that the defendant's not ready to go to trial because there are things he wants to do.
I don't intend my next remark to come as an excuse, but I believe over this period of years, it was generally understood, it was a foregone conclusion that no case was going to go to trial on the original trial date set at A&P. In fact, I would suggest that the original trial date set at A&P was a convention almost. It was a frame of reference for the case. The cases never went to trial on the first trial
date. Wasn't there also an overload of work in the public defender's office too around this time?
There always is, Your Honor.
Uh-huh. So, wondering now whether the stipulations for extension of time, April 15, May 5, May 9, May 24, were not in fact caused by the fact that the public defender's office or the public defender assigned to the case didn't have time to really work on it.
I'd have to say it was a combination of both, Your Honor, but I simply wish to suggest that it was within the context of the fact that everybody knew, the court knew, the prosecutor, the defense knew, that the case wasn't actually going to go to trial on the 16th. The issue was how much of a continuance would there be? How much of a continuance would there have to be based on congestion? And the thing that's different about the 1983 trial date as compared with 1982 is that instead of continuing it to a date certain, it was popped onto Judge Chang's calendar call.
If that's the case, then perhaps your stipulations are a consent to the continuance of the trial.
Just because the defendant can file pretrial motions, just because he's permitted to file further pretrial motions, again, does not necessarily delay the trial. It doesn't have anything to do with trial.
I didn't say it delayed it. I said he may be consenting to the continuance.
I don't believe that any court could infer a waiver or infer consent from any other kind of document. I believe in order for there to be a waiver of speedy trial, it would have to be expressly set forth.
Follow this line of reasoning, if you will. Everybody operates on the premise that it's not going to go to trial on May 16th. A defendant says, well, that's all right with me, just so long as you give me an extension of time within which to file my pretrial motions, and we'll file a stipulation to that effect.
I think a question would have to be answered with reference to the next trial date that was set. Now, in this case, when the case was taken off the calendar in May, no new trial date was set, and that's what's different about May of 1983 as compared with previously. It wasn't just continued a month or two down the road. So at the time when it was taken off the calendar in May, the defense didn't know when the next trial date would be.
Because of extraordinary circumstances, the institution of Master Calendar and Judge Chang at about that time?
It might be if the case was put on the calendar call in May, and that's a missing fact, I suggest. We know it was taken off trial week May 16th, but we don't know when the calendar call June 28th was actually issued. The record suggests that the case was in suspense for a period of weeks, that it was taken off calendar, continued, and then it was
this
reset.
This was the only case where this happened with respect to all other cases when Judge Chang took it off the calendar of other judges and brought it back, that immediately there was a trial date set?
No, sir, but if I understand your question correctly, I don't think the calendar call date was announced at the time the case was taken off the calendar. I think it was taken off the calendar and then it was reset at a later date. The record's not clear on that. And again, if the state wants to enjoy the benefits of an exclusion, I think that they should have come in and made a better record on that. Thank you.
Let me ask another question. I want to see the flip side of this. Judge Yim had the power upon your motion, your side's motion, to dismiss without prejudice, correct?
Yes.
If you had dismissed without prejudice, would you have had grounds for appeal, the without prejudice portion?
I believe we would with leave of court.
You have the power to do it.
Yes.
They say it's discretionary.
Yes, we would.
What would you have?
He had abused his discretion.
Well, how? I mean, what was there in the record that would have shown that he abused his discretion if he had done so? Because you were asking him for dismissal, right?
Yes.
Okay. And he could have, and all the evidence was in there, and he could have done a dismissal with or without prejudice. If Judge Whitman said, I dismiss without prejudice, what in the record, before Judge Whitman or in any other part of this record, would have shown that the without prejudice was abuse of discretion, if anything, that you know?
Because abuse of discretion is such a high standard, I don't feel that an appeal on that basis would have been meritorious. There was evidence to support the judge's finding. Our argument for a dismissal with prejudice, obviously, is the...
So the bottom line of all this is that Judge Wynn could have said without prejudice, and he could have started a new 6 months clock, and you could have been back where you were anyway. Well, who needs that? What's that for?
To properly enforce the rule just as it stands.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good answer. Thank you.
All right.
We'll take the man under advice.
This honorable court of appeals now stands in recess.